wants $3,000 for Lily before retiring as a dive diva, so she ups her price. This does not go down well either. Some men try to dine and dash while others take the insult out on her face. Boutros has broken one man's wrist and crushed another's cheekbone. But Frances doesn't care if her clients hit her. She just cares if she's raped. She doesn't want anything interfering with her plans. Ginger Taylor has been gone in his truck a week and a half now. Frances has kept his purple house under surveillance. She knows he'll be back tomorrow, because she gets close enough to listen. She has motive. She has means. She watches the moon and awaits her opportunity. Tonight, Boutros follows Frances home as usual. He has given up trying to walk with her because she tells him where to go every time. So he escorts her secretly all the way to New Waterford and watches her slip around the back of the house on Water Street. He waits out front for the glow of her candle to appear in the gabled window at the very top of the house. Tonight, as he waits, the headlights of a passing car catch two yellow gleams at the attic window. There's a demon up there, crouched and lying in wait for Frances. Boutros is halfway to the veranda when he sees her light appear and cast a halo of black fur around two yellow eyes. He watches her come to the window, sit on the ledge, and cradle the cat. His face softens. He is glad to see that he is not her only friend. As yet, Boutros has not caught anyone attempting to ambush Frances on her way home. But if he ever does, the fella will die. Snap. Simple as that. When Ginger Taylor returns the next day, he lays Christmas in August on the kitchen table. Rolls of white lace trim and colored ribbon. Yards and yards of fabric. A swatch of sun, moon, and stars against a smoky midnight blue. A bolt of emerald polka dots on iridescent black. Spring flowers for the girls. Gray flannel for the boys. Candy, pineapples, and a whole deer dressed on ice in the back of the truck. Adelaide's eyes water at the sight of the fabric. The ladies she sews for buy some fine cloth, but nothing so jazzy. She has made gowns for most of the white weddings in Sydney. She uses silk, satin, and organdy for her ladies, and her imagination for her family. Often there's a nice piece left over from a job, but if the lady doesn't ask for it back, Adelaide gives it away to a neighbor because it is contrary to her own professional code to dress her children in leftover piecework. She'd sooner turn flour sacks into perfect pinafores, and she does. The Mahmoods were Adelaide's biggest customers till the Teresa fiasco. And when you add that times are worse than ever, Leo has no business throwing money away on all this nonsense. Madeline, Sarah, Josephine, Cleo, Evan, Frederick, and Carvery swarm at the sweets, shrieking, sharing, fighting, and Adelaide wants to know, "What in the name of time is all this, mister?" Ginger beams at her. "It's a whole lot of nothing for no reason." She fingers the fabric. "What did you do? Rob a bank? You'd better have. They've been saving for the kids' school. How could he?" He heads her off. "I got so happy, Addie. I had to go out and waste some money or else bust. Because I love you. Because you are the best woman. You are the toughest, the meanest, the prettiest, and I cannot believe that I got you." He jumps her in a spinning bear hug. "You're crazy. You know that? You're right nuts, and put me down, by." She packs a bony wallop to his soft shoulder. "Put me down till I beat the can off of ya." And he does. "Come on," he says, feinting with a right jab, and she comes at him with a left hook. Wiry she is. Jab, jab at his upraised forearms and dancing fists. Sucks him a good one right in the breadbasket, till she has to double over because she's laughing so hard she might pee, and she can't see to box him any more for the tears streaming down her face. "Invite the neighbors," he tells her. "I'm going to get Tris and Hector. Evan, honey, I want a big fire out back." Evan hops to it. He is the oldest at 12. Barbecued deer and boiled corn. Enough for the neighborhood. And the neighborhood is there in the backyard. The sun is down, the fire is high, and so is the moon. Hector sits under his blanket, wide-eyed and smiling, tapping his foot in real time to the fiddle of the very old Mr. Prince Crawley. Teresa feels well for the first time since she was fired. She had forgotten the sweet joys of society, of just yakking with people, surrounded by kids and food and music. She has made a fish curry fit to cure the dead, renewing her claim to the local West Indian cooking crown, and a tub of ice cream to cool the flames. She goes so far as to let Adelaide persuade her to sing, "Only for you, Addie, and only this once." Teresa starts up one her mother, Clarice, always sang for her in Ginger. "Sly mongoose, sly enough, but the dog knows your ways. Sly mongoose, sly enough, but the cat is on your track." And what good's a song if you don't dance it? Teresa is an excellent dancer when wild horses have got her up and moving. Once moving, she is nothing but happy. "The mongoose went in the missus' kitchen, took up two of her fattest chickens, passed them into his vestcoat pocket. Sly mongoose!" The crowd joins in. The going gets wild. Hector is laughing and clapping, and the little girls have all got up to join Teresa. Her smile is a mile wide. Her hips have gone saucy, fingers snapping, palms percussing. "Go, girl! You look to me like a mile and a quarter. You look to me like you require some water. You look to me like your blood's out of order. Drink bush tea, drinky bush tea." She begins to improvise verses, and it gets hilarious because she makes up all kinds of rhyming gossip about everyone there, and people throw made-up verses back at her. At last, Teresa takes the song back to the chorus, and everyone sings, then shakes the firelight with appreciation. Teresa hasn't caught her breath before she notices Adelaide, alert as a cat, staring at the backyard fence. Before she can say, "What's the matter, dear?" Adelaide has pounced over the fence and down the alley. Adelaide pelts after the small fleeing figure and catches it easily by the collar. "What's going on, eh? Why are you hanging around my family? Fuck off! Ow!" Adelaide has got the fine art of arm twisting. "What's your name, girl?" "Harriet Beecher Stowe, ha ha, ow!" Teresa has caught up. Frances sees her, and can't help but speak to her. "Hi, Teresa." Adelaide looks at Teresa. "Who is she, Tris?" "I don't know, Addie." "Teresa!" Frances looks up at her. "Don't you remember me?" Frances forgets to lie. She forgets about Adelaide pinning her wrist behind her back. She is tempted to tell Teresa everything, because Teresa would understand. Teresa would touch her forehead and everything would fall away. All the weight of everything Frances knows and doesn't know. The terrible weight of her heavy, heavy mind. "Dear God," says Teresa. She has just seen the double row of precious stones on Francis's fingers. "Where did you get those rings, child?"
I found them.
It's sweet like milk. She called me child. Ginger arrives but stops a little way off. Adelaide turns to him.
It's her again. I don't know who she is or what the hell she's after.
No sooner said than Adelaide has an answer to the latter question. Glancing down at her prisoner, she sees Frances staring at Ginger with a cool, cool look on her face.
Who is she, Leo?
Adelaide says sharply, watching his face. He looks back at the phony girl guide, and Adelaide knows the next thing she hears will be a lie.
I don't know, Addie.
Leo has never lied to her before. Adelaide's talent for seeing through a lie could be called a sixth sense. But she doesn't figure there's anything spooky about it. To tell truth from a lie is as easy as salt and sweet.
Never mind, she says to her husband and his sister. Go back and enjoy yourselves. I'll be right there.
But they hang.
Move! Will you, Jesus Christ on the cross, move!
And they do. Adelaide shifts Frances's wrist an eighth of an inch, and so gets her undivided attention. Then she leans her face close in till they are eyeball to eyeball. Quietly and with intent.
You come around my house. You touch my babies or my husband, and I will kill you.
Yes, ma'am.
Adelaide lets go of Frances's wrist and returns to her own backyard. Teresa and Leo have told everyone that Adelaide caught a peeping Tom, a white fella, and put the fear of God into him. Everyone laughs because they pity anyone who crosses Adelaide. And when she comes through the gate looking so grim, they laugh some more. Adelaide marches straight into the house and straight back out with her mouth organ. She plays The Old Rugged Cross. It's bluesy this way, which is how it sounds best. This one always makes Teresa cry, the way Ave Maria does a tired Catholic. Laughing and crying all in the one night, it's been a wonderful party. Except for the dirty girl guide with Mrs. Mahmood's rings. How on earth did she come by them? On the black market? In the gutter? The actual thief must be long gone by now. Teresa was too shocked at the sight to think what to do, but now she knows there is nothing to be done. No point seizing the rings or telling Mahmood. He would never believe her. He's proven that much. And he doesn't deserve the truth.
Forgive me, Lord. Only you know what we each deserve. Anyhow, why get Adelaide all head up about what can't be fixed?
The old rugged cross reminds Teresa to turn the other cheek and not to dwell. What's done is done. Prince Crawley joins in on fiddle. Several sing and Hector hums. It ends the evening in just the right way. Teresa wheels Hector home down the street and shakes off an unsettling question.
How did the little waif know my name?
Ginger makes sure he's in bed ahead of Adelaide. He feels ashamed to be mimicking the sound of sleep as she undresses and crawls in next to him. He's done nothing wrong. But how could he possibly explain? A little white lie and for no reason. It doesn't matter. She watches him for a while, then softly calls him by his secret name. Not Ginger. Another name. It's private. He stirs a little but doesn't open his eyes. She kisses his shoulder and lies down next to him. She'd do anything for her family. The next day, Adelaide arrives home from Beale's grocery with an envelope of bright new buttons.
Josephine, Evan, come here till I annihilate the both of you.
What's this?
I'm sorry, Mama. Sorry, Mama.
Two soft earlobes pierced between stilettoed thumbs and forefingers. I'll tell you what's this. This is your baby brother, Carvery, playing with the stove.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Release earlobes. Ah. He is your brother. You are responsible for him, and you are responsible for each other.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
You never, ever let your family come in harm's way.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am.
Then she threatens them with retribution by their father when he gets home, and the two children breathe a sigh of relief, because what they'll get from their father is, "Well, now, how did that happen?" and a seat in his cushiony lap. At the kitchen table, Adelaide sits down to her buttons and bolts of precious fabric. Princely knickerbockers for Frederick. Gentleman trousers for Evan. White shirts and collars for them both. Sunday dresses decked with ribbons for the girls. A swashbuckling shirt of sun, moon, and stars for Leo, and a matching one for baby Carvery. And finally, although she is mortified to spend the time on it, "I'm only doing this to please you, mister." Sleeveless, slinky, low-slung, black satin and tropical green polka dots. When you see Adelaide in this dress, you'll have to ask her to dance just to feel her slip through your arms like a flashy fish. At the matinee.
"Has the picture started?"
"Nearly over with.
One, please."
Ginger hands over his nickel and enters the Empire. It's a silent, Diary of a Lost Girl, starring Louise Brooks. Not many people. It should be easy to spot Frances if she's here. He stands at the top of the raked aisle and waits until his eyes resolve the shadows into shapes. The outline of her beret. Front row center. But she's not alone. The picture ends. If there were more love in this world, no one would ever have to be lost. The lights come up and he watches Frances rise from her seat. Her companion looks to be a child, though Ginger is wary of jumping to that conclusion anymore. But no, it's definitely a real little girl. He sees that when she stands and turns to collect her sweater from the back of her seat. A really pretty child, with long red-gold hair past her waist. Familiar in some way. Now that he sees Frances next to a real child, he can't imagine how he ever mistook her for one. Actually, her face looks quite old. He watches. The two of them start along their row to the aisle, and the long-haired child seems to stumble to one side. Then again, and with each step. She must have hurt herself somehow, he thinks. But he understands when she rounds the last seat in the row and walks toward him up the aisle. Pretty little gal. What a shame. The youngest Piper child. Of course. And that's who she reminds me of. Her older sister Kathleen. The closer she gets, the more uncanny the resemblance. Ginger waits for Frances to see him. But if she does, she doesn't give any sign. She's chatting to her little sister. Next Saturday is The Wind, starring Lillian Gish. It's about a beautiful girl who goes out west, but when she gets there, the wind buggers her mind. How does it bugger it? Don't say bugger, Lily. Say derange. Derange. Frances puts an arm around Lily and walks right past Ginger.
Hello, Frances.
The long-haired child turns and gives him her green eyes. So like the girl Kathleen. But so unlike, too, because Kathleen never once looked at him. Frances doesn't turn, just yanks the little sister after her, nearly knocking her off balance. Ginger is confused. Is this a slap in the face? If so, what for? He feels like someone's dirty secret. But I'm not. I haven't done anything wrong and don't intend to. Don't want to. But he has to talk to her. Tell her she can't be skulking around his house like that. And not to be coming on like a whore with him. He's not that kind of man. Yes, he has to talk to her as soon as possible. That means the speak. Tonight, Saturday. Ginger has no intention of ever entering that Pandora's box again, so he doesn't even bother to leave his house until 3 a.m., when he knows she'll be leaving. Sorry, Addie, I forgot to tell you. Jamil said for me to come at closing. The second lie. How is Adelaide to protect her family when she doesn't know what from? She had seen with a chill that the fake girl guide bore no goodwill toward her husband. Like a fiend, she looked at him, starved but patient. Adelaide hears the front door shut behind Ginger. She rolls over in bed, wondering, what does she want with him? And what could Leo possibly see in that dirty little white thing? Crazy girl, bad pixie, nobody's child. Adelaide sits up with a jolt as it hits her. He feels sorry for her? Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. Ginger waits behind a wooden support under the rail bridge as the clientele spills out of Jamil's. The piano is going a mile a minute. The funeral march. With the last of the revelers gone, Ginger goes around back. He figures he'll catch her before she gets into whatever car takes her home. He watches from the corner of the building as she comes out. In the cast of light, he sees she's back in uniform, but still in makeup and costume jewelry. A lot of those men in there, and the women, too, who laugh along, they see her as their clown. The whore part is bad enough, but who ever heard of a whore clown? Ginger wonders what it must be like to see through the eyes of those who could find her funny or sexy. She locks the storage room door, and Ginger is about to reveal his presence when she takes off into the dark. What? Where'd she go? He doesn't want to holler. Doesn't want Jamil in on this. He goes around the front. No waiting car, and he's heard no engine. Overhead, the rat-a-tat of a stick along the railway ties. He looks up through the trestle work at the shadow feet flying between the slats and follows at a trot below. The ground rises to meet the rail line, and he runs up the bank, getting winded, but she's still sprinting ahead, taking the ties three at a time with her arms flying out from her sides. By now they're on the edge of town. She tosses away her stick. He bends over to get his breath. He's not the sporty type. When he straightens up, he can see her way ahead in the moonlight, seeming to jump up and down on one spot in a wild step dance, but getting smaller, smaller. He trots on. To his left, the water gleams dark silver beyond the cliff. The sound of his breath and pounding chest drown out his own footfalls, along with the crickets and frogs singing now in the high weeds that line the tracks. They're traveling parallel to the shore road. She's running the whole way. This is how she gets home. Lord. They're way past town. It should be safe to call Fred.
and he's flat on his face on the piss-reeking tracks, his gut shocked airless, his back only now registering the impact that sent him flying forward. Something grabs a fist of his hair and slams him into the gravel again and again and again. And darkness. Tonight, Frances extinguishes her candle before she steps into the attic. It's the moon. Four rectangles of light have swooned through the lattice window onto the floor. The moon may drive men mad, but it can calm a savage girl, for it is cool, precise, it is lucid, especially in such an empty room. Frances pauses and allows herself to be soothed. Then she goes to the window. It's a good night for gazing. One floor below, at the rear of the house, Lily is at her bedroom window watching the creek. Her lips are moving slightly as though whispering to someone down there. But there's not a soul to be seen, just shimmering segments of the moon in the water. Across the hall, and directly beneath the attic window where Frances has just seated herself, James is sound asleep, dreaming plentifully, the way he has since Frances receded from his life. He is a little boy again, and it's just he and his mother in a field of wildflowers. Mercedes is sleeping too, in her spare room, the whites of her brown eyes just showing in slits through nearly closed lids. She dreams of steel, of the color gray, of skeins of gray hair on a loom. Frances strokes Trixie in her lap and realizes she's been followed home. She can see Boutros down there, though he can't see her. He's peering up, waiting for her candle to appear and warm the room. He's staring at the window pane, but all he can see there is the moon. Frances hasn't kept herself a technical virgin just to be raped by someone the size of that. And why else did he follow me home? In her head is the Catholic wife. Years ago, she rifled Ralph Lvovitz's room when they were all supposed to be playing klezmer music downstairs, and robbed him of what every boy should know. The Catholic wife was easier to come by, but is much more complicated. A Catholic wife must keep a graph in her head at all times, plotting the ponderous journey of the ovum, stolid as an icebreaker, to its point of intersection with a zillion speedboats. On average, there are 6 or 7 days a month when this is fairly likely to happen, whereas the rest of the time it's fairly likely not to happen. That's the rhythm method. Like comedy, it's about timing. Rhythm is a sin, of course, but only a venial one, and sanctioned by the Holy Father in Rome, provided you are without lust when performing the generative act and not hoping to get pregnant. Unless you are performing the generative act in order to ward off your husband's lust for another woman, in which case it is a sin for you to give in to his lust, but one mitigated by your intention of preventing him from committing a worse sin with a woman not his wife. Go to confession. You're fine. Every other type of birth control is a mortal sin, for which you go directly to hell if unshriven at the hour of death. Frances gets her period almost not at all, but its scantiness is completely regular. Tonight is the first of 5 or 6 probably fertile days. And this makes her shudder at the thought of Boutros loitering down there in the yard. Because it's bad enough thinking about him going up her, much less a chip off that massive block coming out her 9 months from now. She'll have to speed things up. She is irritated. Why did Ginger Taylor have to turn out to be a nice man? Via Dolorosa. Kabbalah drunks jumped me outside Jamil's. The third lie. Ow, Eddie! Easy! Adelaide picks out another wood splinter and jabs carbolic at Ginger's chewed forehead. Luckily, that's the strongest part of the skull. Lucky, too, that his nose and teeth only grazed gravel while his forehead took the railway tie. Luckiest of all was being lulled awake by the warm buzz of the steel rails beneath him in time to roll over and let the noon coal train pass. Who's his guardian angel? I want to know who she is, and no bullshit. What? But it's useless to pretend. Why did he for one second think she'd buy it? She's one of the Piper girls from New Waterford. Adelaide gets a chill, but she just nods and says, Francis. She knows the bad one is called Francis. I don't know what she wants. I went after her last night, but I got jumped before I could ask her. I don't know by who or how many. Adelaide looks at him, waiting for the rest. I'm sorry, Eddie. I gave her a drive once, that's all. I don't know why I lied before. He's feeling suddenly tired. She's the little girl at the speak, and I wanted to help her. I thought we could help her. Adelaide folds a soft white dressing for his brow. There's a lot of trouble in that family, Leo. That girl is not right in the head. She'll see you in jail for rape. Ginger is shocked. I would never, never. The Pipers have money. You're a colored man, and that girl is after you. With the dressing round his head and his face scabbing over nicely, he knocks at the steel door. You want a fucking raise? Bye. Is that it? No, Mr. Jamil. I just quit. Tell Piper I quit him, too. Tell him yourself. Ginger turns to leave, saying, Then I guess he'll find out when I don't come for your order. Ginger wants a wide berth between him and all things Piper. Fucking nigger! Get the fuck off my property! Boutros! Ginger is already leaving, but he won't run. He glances behind him to see the big sun in the doorway. Ginger is not scared of Boutros. Despite the crack on the neck he got when he grabbed Jamil that time, the boy was just protecting his father. Ginger knows fellas like that are sooner pussycats than fighters. Fucking nigger, mutters Jamil. Get the car, bye. To Boutros, without looking at him. Daddy, I'm going to get married. Jamil wheels and swats Boutros across the face. Get the fucking car. That was around 5 o'clock. What kind of trouble? Ginger asks. Ginger knows the basic facts about the Pipers. What everyone knows and what he picked up driving to and from their house for years. Nowadays, he hauls Piper's booze, but that only ever takes him to the still in the woods, and all Piper ever says is, Thank you, Leo. Drive safe. But Adelaide knows what Teresa has told her. Teresa would never dream of telling such things to her little brother. Ginger was a sweet child, and keeping him from everything unpleasant is second nature to her. Besides, there are some things that are right to tell a woman friend, but otherwise indecent to repeat. Some things, when discussed with a dear husband or brother, are only poison. Good women discuss these things the way epidemiologists identify and track disease without alarming the public. This is woman's work. Men are unfitted for it by nature and should be protected from it the same way women shouldn't have to go down the mines. Men are so innocent. Tell me, Addie. The time has come for inoculation. Adelaide takes a deep breath. The mother committed suicide. That was Mahmoud's daughter, Materia, who ran off with Piper.
Mahmud disowned her. Their daughter, the one with the voice who you drove, Kathleen. She had a baby out of wedlock, the little crippled gal. Piper killed his daughter by not calling the doctor when she was dying in childbed. Pearline Campbell works at Ferguson's funeral parlor. She washed the body. There was a homemade cut in the belly. Pearline and Teresa were girls together. That's how Teresa knows. Years ago, Teresa took a big check to Piper from old man Mahmud. Next thing you know, the singer girl goes to New York City. Meantime, her mother's in rags. The singer girl was a bitch. The mother died the day after her daughter was put in the ground. Not a mark on her but her hair reeking of gas when they brought her to Ferguson's. Teresa went to the mother's funeral and saw the girl Frances laughing. That's what I know. So God knows what else there is, or what that Frances girl was bought up with. She's got a reason to be crazy, boy, but that don't make her innocent. That was after supper. Ginger had changed into his sun, moon, and stars shirt for the meal to mark his release from everything bad. Johnny cake and molasses, beans and Cape Breton steak. Take a pound and a half of bologna, slice it, now scorch it. A celebration. Even though quitting the rum-running business means less money again. Ginger never realized how important the Mahmuds were to his family until Teresa lost her job, and Adelaide lost customers, and he lost most of the legitimate side of his trucking business. And now, here goes the illegitimate side of her. Things have been worse than usual for everyone lately. The Taylors have had it good by comparison. At least they have a future saved up for their kids. They can start living on that. The children are in bed. Teresa has just arrived with Hector, who holds out a date loaf for Adelaide with his big drooly smile. Thank you, baby. Where's your man, Eddie? Teresa asks. Out New Waterford telling Piper he's quit. What's he quit for?
Sidla pour us some tea.
Thank God for tea. Thank God for Teresa, who I can talk to. Hector nods in his wheelchair while Adelaide tells Teresa the whole Frances story and finishes up with, I said to him don't go out there, but he told me it's unmanly not to look a fella in the eye when you're quitting him after all these years. She takes a sip of tea. At least it's all over and done with. Teresa hasn't said a word. Trace. Yes, dear. She's crazy. They're all right nuts. But Teresa is distracted and she gets up. I just want to look at Carvery before I go. Teresa loves to look at Carvery sleep. He looks like Ginger did when he was a baby, and Teresa used to look after him. When she married Hector, she wanted to have a baby as sweet as Ginger. Carvery has inherited his father's nature, too. Sound asleep in his tiny sun, moon, and stars shirt. Sweet, sweet baby boy.
Aunt Teresa.
It's Evan whispering.
Yes, darling.
Sticky Leary snuck in the cloakroom and stole my lunch today. He called it nigger food.
What did he do with it?
He said he threw it away, but I saw him eat it.
He was hungry.
Mama said I should beat the can off him. Do you think I should?
I think he doesn't have enough to eat.
Why doesn't he just ask for some without calling me dirty names?
He's ashamed. So he tries to make you ashamed.
I'm not ashamed of anything. I should just beat the holy crap out of him. Hey, Auntie?
If you want to do the real Christian thing, you put half your lunch in his pocket every day without letting anyone see. And the rest of the time, you forget about him and concentrate on getting where you're going. You're big and strong. You can beat any boy your age, But you start with that, and the game in the schoolyard's going to be who can beat Evan. Then the older boys will get after you, and when the teachers come out, you'll be the one gets blamed. You want to be a boxer when you grow up?
No, I want to be a veterinarian.
Then forget fighting and concentrate on schooling and you'll beat the lot of them. 'Cause, sweetheart, most of them are going nowhere but underground.
Or the steel plant.
That's right. Teresa comes back downstairs. I told Evan not to fight. He asked me.
Good. I told him to ask you.
Adelaide believes that all children should have enough grown-ups around who love them, so that one can tell them to fight, one can tell them not to, and one can tell them not to worry so much.
Teresa leaves with Hector. It's early. They didn't even play cards. Adelaide stands in the open doorway and watches them go. Talk of anything to do with even an offshoot of Mahmood must still upset Teresa.
I'll have to think of something nice to do for Trice. I'll make her a shawl. It's hard, though, because Teresa wants always to give. It embarrasses her to get.
Teresa pushes Hector home down the alley so as to be totally alone. She is in shock about it being Frances Piper, Mahmood's disowned granddaughter. The thin-faced goblin with the unkempt curls and Mrs. Mahmood's rings. She somehow slithered into the house, she's small enough, and stole out of revenge in broad daylight. She stole my job, my good name, my brother's good name. She stole food from his table, and now she's after stealing him.
Teresa couldn't tell Adelaide about the jewels just now. To add it up with Ginger's story, out loud with her best friend, no.
That would have to be all the bitterness poured into one cup, so you could see just how much you had to drink. It makes Teresa dizzy to contemplate it. She will lose her mind with anger.
Oh, Jesus, sweet Lord, please don't let me hate. Look after the cruel and the crazy people, and let me look after my family. Amen.
Even as she prays, Teresa makes a sickening realization. Frances recognized her that night in the alley with Adelaide. That means she's been watching me. During the day in Mahmood's house when I thought I was alone, the girl who laughed at her mother's funeral. Teresa shivers. And she was watching while I danced and sang my mother's song.
The thief you must fear the most is not the one who steals mere things.
Ginger is not home yet. 11 o'clock. Adelaide is uncharacteristically lying to herself.
He stopped at Beale's for a game of cards. He got a flat. He decided to do one more run for Piper at twice the price. I'll hear in a minute.
She must be really scared to be doing this, when what she knows is she's got him.
After the lying phase is the pissed-off phase.
Foolish, head up his arse, idiot. He can pack and shack up with the hunk he slept from hell.
When what she knows is,
she's sick. She's dangerous.
She's with him now. At 6 o'clock that evening, Jamil and Boutros arrived at the place in the woods where Piper makes the moonshine and cuts the liquor.
Fucking nigger up and quit, says Jamil,
getting out on the passenger side. James despises people who say nigger. A civilized man need not resort to barroom slang for emphasis.
Plenty where he came from,
is all James has to say as he hands barrel after case to Jamil, and Jamil hands them to Boutros,
and Boutros slings them into the back of the brand-new black 8-cylinder Kissel Bruum, where the seats have been removed and curtains put up. James looks at Jamil as little as possible. He regrets that his line of work necessitates contact with someone like this. Short black whiskers against a yellowish complexion, oily jet hair and the fusty smell of fried bread. James despises Jamil with his nigger this and nigger that, because it's obvious to him that Jamil is shit scared of being seen as colored. A man who wears his fear on his sleeve is a fool. Besides, thinks James, while Jamil is not black, he sure as hell is colored, because he sure as hell's not white. James is grateful that all his girls turned out so fair. But there's obviously a morbid tendency in the blood they inherited from Materia that made Kathleen lean toward color. James has taken delivery of another crate of books. He has dipped into Dr. Freud in an effort to discover where to lay the blame for Kathleen's perversity. Freud calls women the Dark Continent. James couldn't agree more. He doesn't hate blacks. He just doesn't want them near his bloodline. "You're going to have to do it in 3 or 4 runs," says James, counting the money. "Look, Jimmy, we should buy our own truck and get one of my boys driving." James lets Jamil call him Jimmy, because it is better than having Jamil's greasy mouth on James. Also, when you let someone call you by your not real name, you are reminded every time he says it of what a foolish arse he is. "I don't take partners, Jamil. You buy it, I'll hire it." The back of the car is full, and now Boutros closes the brimming trunk. James can see Materia in that boy. The same vacancy. Standing there staring at me like he's going to say something, then doesn't. Nothing to say, that's why. Not a thought in his head. Creeping idiocy in that family. That's another thing. Boutros starts the car. Jamil slides in next to him. "See you in a couple of weeks, Jimmy." "I better see you in an hour." "What for?" James bends into the open passenger window. "I hired Leo Taylor because I knew I could trust him with merchandise. And until I'm convinced about a replacement, I want you personally responsible." "What are you talking about, by? Boutros will do the runs." "You'll accompany him." "You trust a nigger over my boy? Is that it?"
"This is business, Jamil. I expect to see you back here in an hour, or not at all."
James straightens away from the window. Jamil sticks his head out.
"Fuck you, Piper, you fucking uppity son of a bitch. Did you know you're supplying my place with Piper Pussy, eh, boy? And that she's fucking your precious spade, Leo Taylor?"
James glances through the windshield at Boutros, who's still staring at him. Jamil smirks. James can't lay a hand on him with the big fella sitting there.
"Who are you talking about, Jamil?"
he asks evenly.
"Your daughter Frances, by,"
with a good buddy grin.
"I don't have a daughter by that name."
"Man, he's cool."
"If I don't see you here in an hour, Jamil, I'll assume our deal is terminated."
He turns and walks calmly toward the shack. Jamil is enraged, head and shoulders out the window.
"Everyone's had her, by. Everyone but you, I guess. Or have you had her, too?"
Boutros floors it, and Jamil's head cracks against the outer chrome.
"Shit!"
Boutros gets a row of knuckles to the ear, but he doesn't seem to notice. He's concentrating on James in the rearview mirror, disappearing into the shack. Inside, James has his first drink in 13 years. He'll get this Jamil transaction over with in a few hours.
Then he'll get hold of a rifle and go over to Leo Taylor's place for a talk.
Slow down. You'll have the Mounties on us.
Boutros doesn't register the order.
I said slow down.
But Boutros takes low point at a steady 70. Boutros doesn't say a word throughout the next 3 runs, which makes it no fun for Jamil, who can usually count on, "Yeah, Pa, that's right, Pa," whenever he leaves space for a breath. Jamil sulks in the car while Boutros takes the booze from Piper, who is drunker every time and likewise dead silent. That's how an Anclise gets you, thinks Jamil, with silence. Ice they use. They're smart, but they're not quite human. No feelings. When it comes to his son, Boutros, however, Jamil doesn't think silent. He thinks dumb. Boutros is calm because he has decided that tonight is the night. He'll take money, what he's rightfully earned, from his father's safe. Then he'll go get Frances and they'll drive. Wherever she wants to go. Forget the farm. Forget his mother. That was the dream of a child. The grown-up knows that he has to get Frances off this island right away. There are too many men here who need to be killed. First among them, her own father. What kind of a man disowns his daughter? Frances is a diamond, passed from filthy paw to paw but never diminished. The men who handle her can leave no mark because her worth is so far above them. Hard, helpless, buried. You can hear it in her voice and see it in her eyes. She is waiting for a strong and fearless miner to go way down and rescue her up to the surface where she can shine for all she's worth. Boutros has to get her away tonight, before something happens. He doesn't know what. He had a terrible feeling when his father taunted Piper about having had his own daughter. Boutros knew it must be true. For Frances to do what she does right under her father's nose, Piper must know she's already ruined. And he knows because he ruined her. But Boutros knows that no one is that powerful to be able to ruin something God created good. That was proven by Job. The devil can try, but he can't triumph. Why did Adelaide believe Ginger when he said he was going to square things like a man with Piper? Because she was tired of not believing him. When people get tired, they sometimes do things they wouldn't normally do. Materia went for a nap with her head in the oven. That's not in Adelaide's line. When she gets tired, she stops tasting for truth. In a moment of fatigue, she wanted everything to be all right. But wishing never made anything right. This is what happens when Adelaide stops being tough for a second. If Adelaide weren't in such a hurry, she would run out and lose her supper into the toilet, but there isn't time. So she walks shaky to Beale's grocery on the corner. "Have you seen my man tonight, Mrs.?" is a rhetorical question. Mrs. Beale goes straight to Adelaide's house to mind the children, while Adelaide takes care of her trouble. Wilfred Beale is there with his philosophical white hair. He offers her a drive wherever she might need to go. "I'll let you know, Wilf." She leaves and walks to Teresa's house. Earlier that evening, Ginger had just laid Carvery down in the crib when he saw a light down in the garage. He went out and opened the double doors onto the blazing headlights of his truck. He stood for a moment, temporarily blinded, and heard a soft crying. "Hello," he said. Again, the soft whimper. "It's coming from the cab." Ginger opens the driver's side and sees a dark shape huddled against the opposite door. A small voice says, "Don't tell on me."
His gullet leaps in fear. It's her. Instinctively, he hits the lights and they go out in slow motion.
I'm scared,
she says, her voice muffled behind her hands. I'm not going to hurt you. She says something he can't understand, barely audible and obscured by sorrow. You can't stay here, Francis. The crying starts again, quiet, rhythmically regular, drained of passion. Like a child who's already cried itself to sleep, then reawakened and is now no longer crying to be heard, having given up on that. What's wrong? Soft hiccup. The voice is drenched and exhausted.
Hurt me?
What? He says, stepping up on the running board. She rustles away from him in frightened reflex.
Shh, 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 shh. I'm not going to hurt you. What's wrong?
I already got hurt.
What happened?
I can't tell you.
Yes, you can. But, Francis, you can't stay here. Come into the house.
No!
Fresh terror. Fresh tears.
How can I help you if you won't come inside?
Take me to a safe place.
Where?
A place I know where he can't get me.
Who?
My father.
Francis, did your father hurt you?
No answer. Sound of a hand wiping a wet nose.
What did he do?
She sounds more grown up now. Brave.
I made him mad.
Tell me what he did to you.
Her voice goes cold.
It's my own fault. Sniff. I'm no good. He's right. Why should anyone care about me? Why should you? I'm bad for everyone.
Ginger has found a match in his pocket. As he lights it, she recoils and covers her face with her hands.
No!
He looks at her, curled up in the corner, so fragile. He reaches out, gently pries a hand away from her face, and just before the flame dies, oh, my Lord. He's shocked. Who could do such a thing?
Don't look at me. I'm ugly.
You're not ugly.
Yes, I am. Go away.
You're hurt. I'm going to help you. I'm going to get my wife.
No!
She hisses. Her life depends on this.
No one can know. I came here tonight because you're the only one I can trust. If anyone knows, if he finds out where I am, he'll come and kill me.
She takes a deep breath.
I can understand if you're not willing to help me. You have enough troubles. Thank you anyway.
The passenger door clunks open in the dark. Wait, wait! She pauses, her feet dangling.
Where do you need to go?
It's about 5 miles out of New Waterford. No one knows about it. It's an old mine. I've got food and money. If I can stay there a couple of days, he'll think I'm already off the island. Then it'll be safe to hitch a ride to the ferry and go.
Go where?
Just go.
He hesitates.
Forget it, she says. Sorry to bother you, Mr. Taylor.
I'll take you.
Silence.
I said, I'll take you there, Francis.
God bless you.
Just wait here a minute.
Boutros is serene behind the wheel. They're heading back to Sydney. It's the last run of the night. The sun's long gone. It was a too hot day. If Francis agrees, they'll drive to British Columbia. He wants to grow things. Cherries and grapes for wine. The thought of his own orchard, and Francis free and flourishing among rows of gnarly trees in bloom, full fruit, heavy vines. He pictures stuffing their own grape leaves with rice and lamb. He loves to cook, anything that consists of something wrapped around something else. Driving is a wonderful place for dreaming. Boutros doesn't enjoy violence. It's just the job he's always done for his father. Mostly it consists of walking into other men's violence and turning it off for them, like groping for a switch in a dark, cluttered basement. To do this, he often has to hurt them. He rarely gets angry, though he got angry last night with Taylor on the rail tracks. Boutros spared him for Mrs. Taylor's sake. She's a hard-working woman and doesn't deserve to be a widow. And Taylor seems to have learned his lesson and backed off.
"Slow the Jesus down, you moron!"
Jamil's nerves are shot. Up ahead comes Leo Taylor's truck. It whizzes past them on the land side of the shore road. The 1 second aperture of his headlights has taken a picture for Boutros, which is just now coming up in black and white through the film on his eyes. Frances in the cab, looking straight at him, her face a battered mess. Taylor at the wheel, laughing at her.
"What the fuck are you doing?"
Jamil grabs the dashboard and goes slamming into the passenger door as glass collides in the back.
"Shit!"
And the Kissel fishtails out of the U-turn, speeding after the truck in a wake of rye whiskey.
"Leo Taylor's got Frances," Jamil screams. "So the fuck what?"
And begins slapping Boutros. Boutros puts up a hand to keep his line of vision clear. They're gaining on the truck.
"She's my cousin. She's a whore. Don't talk about her like that."
Jamil starts laughing. Boutros trembles.
"You sweet on her, boy, eh? You sweet on the whore? You smelled her? Ha ha!"
Boutros blinks hard.
"You gonna cry now, cry baby?"
Boutros does have tears in his eyes.
"Eh, little sissy boy, suki baby, eh, little mama's boy, gonna cry now, eh? Go ahead, go on."
The windshield explodes with Jamil's head, shattering Boutros's view of the road. He sticks his head out the window just in time to swerve out of the way of an oncoming carload of nuns. His hand is still around the back of his father's neck as the Kissel hurtles off the road, over the ruts and along the cliff at 80, till the terrain changes abruptly to silent air. Jamil is dead before they hit the rocks below. The nuns turn around and drive back, dropping off three of their number to investigate while the other three drive back to New Waterford to get an ambulance. By the time the rugger-playing one picks her way down to the water's edge, there is only one man, his neck all but severed. The other man is found the next day. The engineer didn't quite manage to stop the coal train in time, but the big man lying on the tracks was already dead.
"I'll just talk to Piper and turn right around and come home," Ginger had told Adelaide just after 9. "I love you."
It gave him a twinge when she said his private name. But he wasn't lying for his own sake. And this time there was a reason. To protect that poor beat-up girl waiting for him in the truck. In a couple of days, she'd be gone right off this rock. And that gave him a light feeling even as he told the lie. It's a cloudy night, but Ginger gets a good look at Frances as they pass the fires of the steel plant. There's blood crusting her nose and filling the gully that meets her upper lip. The lip is split and fat on the left side. Her left eye is likewise puffy and blacked. That Piper is more than just a negligent father. This explains everything.